home. We are WNST, AM 1570, TASS of Baltimore. We are Baltimore positive. We are positively into the spring training baseball thing. Yes, I am wearing my Curio, a rented orange Baltimore bird. We've had bird tapes. I deemed John Eisenberg earlier this week, now that he's doing his bird tape second season, I deemed him the bird keeper. So this is the guy who keeps our birds aflame here in the nest. Luke Jones joins us now. It is not purple, it is orange. We got plenty of purple, dude. It's crazy week, right? Like tampering weekend. Towson's playing. We're going to be over at CVP in Towson at noon on Sunday. We'll be there again on Monday night, Tuesday night, as long as it takes to get one of these local teams into the tournament. And we had Pat Scherrie on last week. We had all this stuff going on, but spring training, injuries, right? There's news, not great news, and in any way, the really bad news is that plane that was headed to Tampa on Monday morning that you and I are not on because of the tampering period. Don't laugh at me. I'm still upset about this. I mean, but it might be 65 here on Tuesday, so that'd be nice. But the spring training thing has really changed for the Orioles, and we'll get the tampering in the Ravens and Justin Tucker and all that other nonsense. But there's like real baseball news, and not what we want to be talking about this time of year, which is, opening day, will this guy be available? Boy, boy, oh boy, it's not even St. Patrick's Day, man.
Yeah, I mean, this is the problem with spring training or with training camp when we're talking about the Ravens and the NFL, where if there's news this time of year, generally speaking, it's not great news. Now, let's be clear. I don't think there's anything here that warrants the panic button just yet. But it's not ideal when your best player, Gunnar Henderson, is dealing with an intercostal strain, minor as it might be, when you're 3 weeks out from opening day and you're hearing Brandon Hyde say they're still very, very hopeful he's ready for the opener. Now, let's be clear. You need to be careful with these type when you're talking about an intercostal strain or an oblique, which is obviously something that's quite common in baseball. You want to be careful this time of year. And if that means that Gunnar Henderson has to miss the first series or two of the season, then so be it, because you don't want him to be dealing with this in June and July. But it's not what you want to hear. It's certainly not how you want to start off the season, potentially. And
Well, especially we know we're getting out of Rutschman too, right? Like at
oh,
least.
sure. I mean, regardless, put Rutschman aside. I mean, Gunnar Henderson himself. I mean, this guy was MVP of the American League through the first 2.5 months last year. Now Aaron Judge the rest of the way. Enough said. And Bobby Witt, for that matter, as well. And Gunnar was not dominant in the second half of the season, but you're talking about one of the five best players in the American League, if not all of baseball. So you want to make sure he's right. It's not something to panic about, but it's one of those when you're dealing with a side or a rib cage issue for a baseball player with the way they twist their trunks swinging the bat. That's something you need to be very, very careful with. That's something that you're not trying to play through in mid-March. So the Orioles are going to be smart about this. Gunnar Henderson's going to be smart about this. And for some context, keep in mind he dealt with an oblique issue very early in camp last year, and he ended up being fine, right? So this isn't to sound the alarm that he's doomed, the Orioles are doomed, anything like that, but you want to be careful with it. And the Orioles are going to be, and that's why we're not going to see Gunnar Henderson out on the field for Grapefruit League action, at least for the next couple weeks. So, there's that. For me, the one that's a little more unsettling is Andrew Kittredge with his knee. When you hear Brandon Hyde say that they had imaging done, which, okay, an MRI can be a very precautionary, very preventative a measure when you're talking about something like that. But when you hear then that they're going to gather some other opinions and you hear second opinions, then you start to wonder, okay, is this something where there's some kind of a surgery or a scope on the table? Or is this something that they can't quite figure out why his knee's inflamed? That's something that, not that Andrew Kittredge is going to be their closer or anything like that, but this guy was signed to be an important part of their seventh and eighth inning picture, and a guy that, on any given night, maybe you ask to close, depending on the state of the rest of your bullpen. So,
I would say he's a guy they're counting on, not a guy they're hoping on. You know what I mean?
I mean, any reliever you're going to give $10 million to, I mean, you're counting on to be a real part of your bullpen. Again, that doesn't mean he's, that the bullpen is completely sunk without him, but when you're hearing knee inflammation. It sounds a little mysterious in that way. He can't quite explain it. And when you hear that he's getting an MRI and they're gathering some opinions, that's where you wonder, okay, is this a little more, is there a little more to this
Yeah,
than.
next thing it happens, there's the scope.
Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly. And again, we're not talking necessarily that it's a season-ending thing or anything crazy, but when you're getting 3 weeks out from opening day, even for a reliever who's only going to pitch an inning at a time, there's still a ramp up here that you want a guy to be able to go through. So that's unsettling, that's unnerving, at least until we get a little more clarity on it. But you're talking about someone that, let's face it, when they pivoted to Andrew Kittredge, remember, that was on the heels of them exploring a deal with Jeff Hoffman, which the reports indicate that the Orioles had a 3-year agreement with him until they had some concerns about his shoulder. Now they kept it under wraps, and he ended up signing with Toronto, and things worked out fine for him as well. But this was the fallback option. So there's some irony, I think, when you're talking about someone else that you had some health concerns about. And then suddenly your fallback option has a concern, although it's not arm related, but still a knee, if a pitcher's dealing with a knee issue, he's not gonna be able to pitch.
There are no good injuries this year. I mean, pick the pinky winky, pick the groin, pick the, whatever it is. If it hurts, if it's a backache,
Yeah,
it's no good. You can't
I mean, some are worse than others, of course, but yeah, especially when you're now getting to the timeline where you're 3 weeks out. And it's baseball. There are no off days. It's not like, hey, you can just rest during the course of the week, like in the NFL.
I want to say something too about baseball, and maybe I'm wrong about this. You can correct me, okay? And maybe I'm speaking off the cuff as a former media member. It feels to me, and I think the reality would be, and I'd have to talk to players about this, if Mike Bordick were in the room with me or somebody like that, that this time of year is more stressful on their bodies than the season in a lot of ways. Because of the running around you're doing at 7, 8, 9 o'clock in the morning, all day long, the poking, the prodding, the bus riding, the back and forth, the two innings here, the up, the down. Once you get into the season, you know where the hotel is, you know where the bar is, you know where the room, you know where you're parking, like there's much less baseball and more like get in the weight room, get in the tub, do that sort of thing, be ready to go run, little BP, stretch, stay loose, all of that. This time of year, it feels more grindy. Even if they're out fishing or doing whatever they're doing this time of year. And I would think there's a lot more video study. Everybody's Tony Gwynn in the modern era trying to work on this and that. I don't think Jackson Holliday has hobbies at this point. He's 19. I think his hobby's like trying to make $100 million as quickly as possible. And yeah, like literally, and all of what they put their bodies through and recovery and all of that. I would see spring training as being more likely to get injured because you're just sort of farting around, running around, doing drills, doing stuff that on a Tuesday night at Yankee Stadium, you're waking up in a hotel, you're going to the ballpark, and you're stretching, and then you play. Some guys don't even play, right? Right? Or if they play a little bit. It's not an aerobic game at all. It's not at all. There's no running in baseball except from here to there. So, all of this stuff, I think it's easier to get hurt in spring training. I'll just say that having done 15 spring trainings, oh, I've probably done 20 spring trainings if you count the ones I've gone to as a fan out in Arizona. I've been to Arizona 6 times for spring training. So if I owned the team, we'd be in Scottsdale. I'll tell you that right now, but where it doesn't rain. But I would say it's harder. I think it is anyway.
I mean, there's probably something to that. I would say, I don't know if I'd say harder, but it's a different environment, right? And you have
More ways to
players.
get hurt is what I would say. More
Okay.
ways to get hurt.
Yeah. Well, I think, especially on the pitching side, and obviously we're further removed from this at this point because these guys have been in, I mean, they've officially reported in mid-February, but so many of these guys are showing up by late January, right? I mean, I think if you were down at the Ed Smith Complex in Sarasota in late January, you'd find a lot of these guys were already there. But there is a, there's a not that they're not that it's so intense that they're there 14 hours a day or anything crazy like that, but it is a little bit of a different routine. I mean, let's use Jordan Westberg as an example, and there doesn't seem to be any concerns with him. In fact, he might be back in the lineup as you and I are people are hearing our conversation. But he rented an Airbnb at a soft mattress and messed with his back, right? Instead of his typical mattress that he has for 81 home games in Baltimore. Now, obviously, that can happen on the road or over the course of a regular season, but those are just like the examples of things that you find. I think with pitchers and why there's so much trepidation when pitchers and catchers report on the pitching side, there's always that element of how's a pitcher's elbow? How's his arm? What was his training regimen? What was his workload last season? Was there a lingering issue at the end of last season that wasn't detected over the winter? Because you take that time off and then you start to ramp up and then it shows up, right? Almost like the Kyle Bradish thing last year, which, okay, the elbow issue was detected. He first noticed it in January, but was that something that he actually did? I don't know, in late September. Did he do that at the end of the previous season and just never really felt it that much until he started to ramp back up? So, these guys all have different training regimens and philosophies. Not that the teams aren't standardized, but different players you talk to them. Some guys take a month off when the season ends. Some guys take 2 months off when the season ends. I heard Harold Reynolds talking about this on MLB Network the other day, and how I think when he was in Seattle, he was talking to their head trainer, their head strength coach, whatever that title was at the time, and he kind of had a thought about what he was going to do in the off season, and the trainer's like, "No, you're going to relax for the next 2 months." And so there are always different philosophies, whether you're talking about hitting or on the pitching side. But this time of year, when you're really starting to ramp up, and to your point, when it's in a little bit of a less familiar environment than what you're used to over the course of a 6, maybe 7 month regular season and postseason combined, that you can have some things happen here and there. So again, when bringing it back to Gunnar Henderson, if he's not there for opening day, assuming we're taking all of this at face value, it's a very minor intercostal strain, which is it's the muscles, the muscles in the rib cage. You want to be careful there, right? You don't want him pushing through playing in Grapefruit League games the 3rd week of March if that means he's going to be dealing with this come June, right? So you want to be careful. And if he has to miss a few games, if he has to miss a series, if he has to miss a week, if he has to miss 10 days, if that means he's going to be fine and right the rest of the season, then you have to do that. I mean, there's no debating that. Those games in late March and early April aren't that important,
I would
but
say for any of these guys, if they wake up
yeah,
sore, they take
sure.
the day
You have to be
off,
careful. You have to
right?
be careful, right?
Literally,
So
yeah.
that's where they are with Gunnar Henderson. We mentioned Andrew Kittredge, where there's still some unknown there. Again, when you hear second opinions, it's not great. That's not ideal to hear that because that tells you that there's either some concern or that tells you there's some disagreement as far as what exactly is causing this, right? And the indications are it's not like it's this major injury that he has, but just dealing with inflammation. What's causing that? Is it a meniscus issue? Is it some scar tissue? Like whatever. But you want to find out. And again, now for a pitcher specifically, it's one thing to talk about hitters, but for pitchers who go through progressions, if he's shut down for a couple of weeks, even if he's fine in 10 days, you are starting to get to a timeline where you wonder if he's ready for the start of the season or does he have to start the year on the IL, which in this case, probably opens the door for Brian Baker to make the club or something like that. So again, it's not the end of the world, assuming it's not something any major, anything colossal, anything major. One name I do want to bring up because it was kind of an odd circumstance when he made his start on Wednesday. Grayson Rodriguez says he was fine after the game. Said he felt, I think the quote was, he was sluggish, which. There has been some sickness going around Orioles camp. I know Tyler O'Neill was ill, and some other guys have been under the weather. I mean, it's the end of winter, right? I mean, there's respiratory stuff. There's been stomach stuff. I think many of us have dealt with it in our own families. It going around, but with Grayson Rodriguez on Wednesday, the velocity was down a little bit. In fact, I think he topped out at 95, and the Statcast info kind of said he was at 93, which is
Well, this is where you talk about warning signs about
Yeah,
things that are
it,
just sort of like concerning.
right. And
Serious and con no, it's not serious and concerned. That's Justin Tucker. Sorry, just concerning. How about that?
yeah, this is something to monitor. I would put it in that category. And he was asked about this, and even his first start, which was in Sarasota, they don't have Statcast data there, but he was on the road on Wednesday. There was Statcast data. He threw one pitch to start the second inning. I think it was 90 miles per hour. It's like 89.7. I mean, that's not Grayson Rodriguez right there. Now, he did say, and he had even said in previous interviews down in spring training, he did tweak his mechanics a little bit with in an effort to not put as much strain on his lat muscle, which, if you recall, that's what cost him the last 2 months last year. It's the injury that he had in the minor leagues in 2022. So there's some recognition of maybe tweaking your mechanics a little bit
There's
to not put.
science here, right? Like literally, they've said
Sure.
you're doing this instead of that is
I mean,
causing a rub, right?
there's
Yeah.
science that aids with that, but it's still not a perfect science, right? So, but anytime you run the risk of a pitcher or a hitter, for that matter, if they're talking about changing their swing or anything like that, you have new muscle memory that needs to be built, and you do want to be careful that there isn't an injury, there isn't some kind of a physical concern. Again, he downplayed that. He didn't say that his arm felt bad or that there was an injury or anything like that. He talked to the media after the outing. I mean, the Orioles have become very much like the Ravens and NFL teams that if there's a physical concern with a player, they're not going to just send them out there in front of the media right away. So to me, that seemed to be a good sign internally, but it's something worth monitoring. And he did note that, hey, we're still 3 weeks out from the start of the season. I'm not emptying the tank. I'm not emptying the clip. In terms of my velocity. So just watch it, right? I mean, that's something you just want to keep an eye on because, that velo, especially, okay, 93 is one thing, right? I mean, someone that you're used to seeing throw 95, 96 and touching the high 90s, that's what you expect. So if he's throwing 93, if he's topping out at 94 or 95 in his second spring start, okay, but when you see 89.7 or whatever it was, okay, that's a bit much in terms of not really going all out. Just watch it, right? Just monitor it. I think there's going to be a lot of interest in what his next outing looks like. I'm sure Brandon Hyde will be asked about him at least once, between now and his next outing. And again, not at all trying to speculate that there's an injury, but when you see diminished velocity, when you're talking about an average fastball that's down, I think it was 2.5 miles per hour, 3 miles per hour, something like that. You want to watch it, right? And again, he said he felt sluggish. Maybe he's getting sick. Maybe he's under the weather. As I said, some of that was going around camp as well. So if it was that simple, then fine, right? No problem then. But we've talked about how important Grayson Rodriguez and his ability to take us the next step is for this club right now that has all of these pitchers that you kind of view and say, okay, number three starter, number four starter, number five starter, but they're really counting on Grayson Rodriguez and Zach Eflin at the top to really lead the way. And then, as we've said, then you see what happens as you get into the summer, you get closer to the trade deadline, you see if there's that right move to make that you can add a number one starter or another number two starter to throw into the mix. But all of those plans have depended on a healthy Grayson Rodriguez. So when you see him have, just a real, probably the kindest way you could describe that outing, it was as blah, right? I mean, and that was kind of the way he described it, how he just didn't feel all that strong and just didn't have as good command, which, hey, pitchers can have that stuff too. We've all, any baseball fan who follows spring training knows that guys can sometimes get a little bit of a dead arm as you get, we're approaching halfway through camp, it's something to watch, right? It's something to monitor. It's not something to panic about at this point. But I think there's going to be a little more attention than normal for his next outing to make sure that he bounces back. So that's kind of the update right now. I mean, one thing that I forgot to mention, at least in passing, if Gunnar Henderson isn't ready for opening day, keep in mind Jorge Mateo is still recovering from the elbow. So I don't know what that means for shortstop for the Toronto series or whatever, but you got to be careful with these guys. You have to understand that there's no such thing as playing through injuries in the Grapefruit League. And really, by extension, you really shouldn't be pushing through trying to play through injuries the first week, the first 2 weeks, even the first month of the season, knowing just how long of a marathon it is, and knowing that you don't want to be messing with rib cage and side issues when you're talking about a hitter like Gunnar Henderson, just knowing how incredibly important he is to this team.
Luke Jones is here. He is Baltimore Luke. Big thanks to our friends at Curio Wellness. I'm wearing my Curio orange shirt here. We'll get to some purple and some other things. I've had all sorts of rock stars on this week, and John Palumbo and Crack the Sky talking some old stuff. Rick Emmett from Triumph has a new book out on guitar stuff. So we're doing some music, we're doing some politics, we're doing some State House, doing a whole bunch of different things around here. If you haven't heard my piece with Julie Sharper, who did all of the reporting on Justin Tucker, definitely want you to check all that out. And if you're Towson fan, we hope to see you on Sunday over at CVP, Charles Village Pub. Everybody knows where that is. Big Towson party going on Sunday at noon. Hopefully that extends to Monday and then Tuesday. We will be doing the show at Fadley's this week, at CVP in Towson next Friday, and then at Pizza John's 2 weeks from Friday. That will be the 21st, which will be our last show before opening day. And then after opening day, we're actually going to be at Fadley's on the 2nd of April again to celebrate the Red Sox coming to town. Luke, just to wrap things up on pitching, we didn't talk Sagano, we didn't talk Batista. You know,
The
certainly
good news.
Charlie Morton. I mean, maybe it was Monday. You know, they're going to pitch again. Maybe by the time people even hear this or whatever. But watching the broadcast, feeling it up. I mean, certainly, Charlie Morton feels like a big time grown up kind of a guy. And you know, I heard his accent. I'm like, you know, his accent kind of reminds me of Joe Flacco. Because then I looked him up. I'm like, oh, they're only like 40 miles apart. And you know, and then that's why they all talk like that.
I'm glad you brought that up, because those were actually more positive individuals to talk about at this point in time, as we were kind of
Well,
look.
Batista's its own thing, right? Like,
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you had a chance to watch his inning, but other than the velocity not being up to full-blown pre-elbow injury form, Batista looked good. The splitter looked good. I thought his
well, he knows
command,
how to do this, right? There is some,
I mean, and he was, his fastball mostly sat 96, but he touched 97. When you're talking about your first live game action in what, 16, 17 months, whatever it is, I'll take that, right? And I don't think there's any concern, as long as he's feeling good, that his velocity is right there. And to your point, when we in one of our more recent discussions, you even talked about, does Felix Batista, it's not like he has to throw 101, 102 to be successful. Now, that said, you don't want him throwing 93 either, right? I mean, you still want him to be Felix Batista. But here's the thing to remember about him. Whenever you're talking about pitching, right, it's 60 feet, 6 inches from home plate to the rubber. But a pitcher of the height and size of him, the extension that he gets, 97 miles per hour from him throwing it, compared to a pitcher who's 6'1", that's way different, right? That's way different. That's why Felix Batista throwing 102, you say, forget about it, right? I mean, because he gets the kind of extension, it feels like he's, 45 feet away from you by the time he releases the ball. So that was good news. Sagano, I think what's interesting about him, I mean, he has a six pitch assortment. By most accounts, his splitter, which he struck out Alex Bregman on a good splitter on Monday, got him looking. And the cutter, those are kind of regarded as his best pitches. But even watching him on Monday, I mean, he's not going to overwhelm you. He's going to have a fastball 90, 91, 92. He's not going to overwhelm you with stuff. But go look at his career numbers pitching in Japan with the command, his control. He doesn't walk guys. When you have a six pitch assortment, I mean, really, someone like him, and this is where Adley Rutschman and Gary Sanchez, for that matter, are going to factor in so much, and everything they do from an analytics standpoint between starts. Pitch sequencing is going to be so important for Sagano, because when you have that kind of assortment, if you can command it all and you can put it where you want it, you should be able to keep these hitters off balance. Now, what's that going to look like in the major leagues? I don't think the Orioles are expecting him to be a number one starter. I mean, they didn't pay him like that. Right. But I think there's certainly an optimism that even at his advanced age, even acknowledging he's never pitched in the majors, they clearly saw something in him that they liked. And keep in mind, this is someone that Adam Jones, who's back with the organization in a consultant on a consultant basis, and has given input. He faced this guy. Adam played in Japan a couple years, and he was familiar with this guy. And Adam, I think he's not going to, he's not going to Buffalo you. If he believes a guy can pitch in the majors and be effective, he's going to tell you, and if not, he'll tell you, right? So they even, I don't know if I want to say it's inside intel, because it's not like Jones is best friends with the guy or anything like that, but they had someone who they trust as far as have some opinions, and he thought that, hey, this guy can pitch in the majors. So was good to see him do what he did on Monday. Again, that someone else that just want to give him reps, get him a chance to get familiar. I mean, even things as simple as the strike zone, the baseball is different in the major league compared to pitching in Japan. So he's got to adjust, and there'll be some growing pains, I'm sure. But I think there's definitely some optimism with how he's looked so far. And you mentioned it with Charlie Morton. I mean, look, I think what's fascinating, I've alluded to this, but Charlie Morton is so fascinating in the sense that he has reinvented himself multiple times in his career. I mean, you go back to what he was early in his career, he gets to Pittsburgh. That was at a time when the Pirates with Neil Huntington, they were one of the earliest teams to go all in on infield shifting and pitchers throwing two-seam fastballs and getting ground balls. So he became a two-seam fastball guy. He gets to Houston, and the thoughts, no, we think you have a good curveball, and we want you to throw your curveball with a four-seam fastball up in the zone. And that's what he became in Houston. And later in his career, his stuff isn't as devastating as it was, several years back. I mean, he's 41 years old,
And he
but
knows that, most importantly.
sure, of course, but he's going to throw a lot of curveballs. I mean, go look at his Fangraphs page. You'll see that his primary pitch is not the fastball. He throws his curveball. He throws it a lot. And that's going to be the main thing that he kind of sets pitchers up with. He doesn't get a ton of, he's not going to get a ton of swing and miss, but he still averaged about a strikeout per inning last year. So, he still gets enough, more than enough.
But if you
So I
play defense against a curveball pitcher and beat the ball into the ground,
keep him off balance.
yeah, I mean, guys that have trouble hitting curveballs really have, Pedro Serrano, right? Now, not a lot of guys in the big leagues have that issue, but it's a game of fooling them, right? It's
I mean, there's
literally.
still way more guys that have that issue than you would think, right? I mean, everyone in the minor leagues can hit a fastball. And even in this day and age, it used to be, well, can you hit a 98 mile per hour fastball? Well, heck, go through these bullpens. Everyone has that now, right? I mean, not everyone, but a lot,
Well,
so
if you
many
can't
guys
hit
do.
that, you're not here anymore.
Exactly,
Yeah.
exactly. So I think with Morton, look, the questions about his age are fair, right? I mean, it's not like he put up amazing numbers in Atlanta the last couple years, right? But
But
I
these
think
guys like him too, from the Houston chain that they
sure.
came from. They're very comfortable with him in the way that John Harbaugh brings Brent Urban back every year in
Oh,
some way, right?
and this is, this is the latest iteration of Jordan Lyles, Kyle Gibson. Corbin Burns was a different animal because you're talking about a Cy Young pitcher, but there was also a veteran purpose to each of those moves, and Charlie Morton fits that description this year. Now, he needs to be able to go out and perform, right? I mean, you didn't give him $15 million just to be
Feels like he'll be
there.
capable of being what they want him to be, which is a
I mean,
guy that takes the ball every fifth day and has an ERA of four
make
something.
30 starts, I mean, that's the thing you look at. When you look at Charlie Morton the last few years, even in his advancing age, where you're talking about a guy that, one thing that was wild, Nestor, I didn't even know this. He will, and this was according to Sarah Langs, great MLB researcher. I saw this on Twitter. He's going to, when you exclude St. Louis Browns history, which I always do when talking about the history of the Orioles, I go from 1954 on. This guy's going to be the oldest pitcher to have started games for the Orioles at 41. I was shocked by that, right? I mean,
I don't know, dude. That's a hell
I
of a
started.
trivia question. Hold on, let me think of who would have been 40 or who they've rented around here. I mean, they had Jim Thome, they had Sammy Sosa, they had some guys at
I
the
mean,
end
there
of
aren't that
whatever
many
their
40
careers
some.
were.
Right,
But
there
the
aren't that
40
many 40.
something year olds,
Yeah.
they've stunk for so long. And, Wilbur Wood's still not doing it. And, Terry Forster, those guys that sort of hung around a million years ago smoking cigarettes and pitching until they were 41 with a knuckleball, Hoyt Wilhelm or something like that. I mean, Doug Trabeck might have been 36, 37 when he was here. I'm thinking that even the Chris Bensons and those guys were 32, 33. They were contract guys in their early 30s that you thought, I don't know, dude. I'm trying to think of any pitcher they've
Yeah.
had around here over 37, 38, 39. Like literally ever back to my era. I mean, even the Mark Williamsons and the guys that were kind of old and tired, they were only 33, 34. I mean, to Jamie Moyer would be a different thing, but he did all that in Seattle. I mean, Jamie Moyer was 31 or 32 when he got here, and he pitched
Exactly.
15 more years. So I don't know, dude. The oldest pitcher in Oriole history. Wow. Palmer. Palmer. Palmer?
He wasn't 41. Palmer would have been, let's see. So he
Well, he
was.
was when he did that stupid comeback in spring training in
Oh,
80,
well,
whatever.
but we're
Yeah.
not counting that because
Yeah,
he
I'm
did,
not counting
because
that. No.
right, it didn't
He was
happen in the
already in the
regular
Hall of
season.
Fame when he did that. Yeah.
Yeah, that was strange. But
I mean, you were a
yeah.
kid, but I remember it.
Right. Oh no, I don't remember any. Obviously, he was done in 84, but that was the spring of 91. I remember that.
Palmer was
I
probably
absolutely
38
remember
when he
that.
hung him up, right? Probably.
He was 39. So
Okay.
yeah, and let me be clear. I don't know about any 40-year-olds, but when we're talking about 41-year-olds to have started, this doesn't, you know, that we're excluding relievers here because I'm sure someone we're not thinking about on that front. But the only other three, these were all St. Louis Browns era. Eddie Plank in 1916 and 17 made 20 starts. Fred Johnson in 38 and 39 made 8 starts. And here's a good name for you for the St. Louis Browns 1951 through 1953. Satchel Paige made 13 starts. So there
Satchel
you
Paige
go.
was an Oriole. Come
Oh,
on.
he's a St. Louis Brown. Yeah. St. Louis Brown. Again, I'm just giving you the context. And again, this was Sarah Langs, the great MLB researcher, put this out on Twitter a few days back. I thought that was really neat. So yeah, Charlie Morton, some uncharted territory in terms of a 41-year-old to start games for the Orioles, you know, starting pitchers. So look, you want to be realistic, right? I mean, he's not going to be the guy that he was when he was an all-star pitcher. Going back to 2019, 2018, 2019 with Houston and Tampa Bay. But hey, if he can duplicate what he did for the Braves last year, which was 30 starts, a 4.19 ERA, average a strikeout per inning, you know, that you don't want him to be much worse than that, certainly, but you'll take that because, as we've said, you need pitchers who can take the ball, right? Not everyone's going to be Corbin Burns. Not everyone's going to be Zach Eflin. Not
To me,
everyone's going
he's
to
a
be.
guy they want coming out of the bullpen in October for two or three innings. Like that's the kind of human they're going to want around in playoff time because there are no 7-inning pitchers in October, you know.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, so he's part of an arsenal, right? I mean, that's the way I'm looking at this. Dude, I've got people. I did an event. Big thanks to Mike Tisch and the folks over at with the Connects event. But I did a Connects event and I buddy of mine from Strategic Factory comes over. He's all pissed off at the Orioles and the pitching and the blah, 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 blah. I'm like, what did you want them to do? Well, if they weren't going to sign Burns, they should have thrown $200 million at blah. And I'm like, ah, man, I don't know. I mean, it ain't my money,
Yeah.
you know, but I try to
Well,
be sensible about what their capabilities are. I mean, they solved the Masson thing since the last time you and I
I was
got
going to say
together.
we're 40 minutes into our conversation and we haven't even talked about Masson. But yeah,
Talk
no,
about
I
cost certainty.
yeah. But look, I'll hear that argument and remember, I was the guy saying, you know, instead of Sagano and Charlie Morton, you know, I would have been inclined to say one of them and maybe I would have taken a little more of a risk, but a little more of a higher reward profile on someone like Walker Buehler, who the Red Sox gave $20 million to this year, right? On a 1-year deal. And look, Walker Buehler may end up being worse than Charlie Morton and Sagano, but, you know, I would have at least aimed for for one pitcher like that. But yeah, I'll hear you. And look, I would have explored Blake Snell. I would have explored Max Fried. Like, you know, I would have looked at those guys too. But yes, it's very easy to be sitting there and just saying, you know, it's not my money. Go throw $200 million at a guy who, you know, any of these pitchers feel like they're a ticking time bomb at times. You know, when you're talking about health in 2025 and the Tommy John epidemic and all that. So, you know, we're going to see how it plays out. And I think where you take some, you know, you take some solace, you take some, you know, you have some optimism is you hope that with new ownership that you know you have the prospects and the farm system that come May, come June, come July, if the right pitcher is out there and you have a clear need. And again, this is knocking on wood right now that Grayson Rodriguez is fine and he was just sluggish and all that, then that you can go out and make a move, right? Whether it's a rental or whether it's another Zach Eflin situation where you rented a pitcher, but hey, he also has another year left on his deal. So you saw how that worked out. So,
Where
you
were
know,
you on
we're
the
gonna.
Max Fried thing? I haven't heard you talk about it because I had people come up to me talking to me about that. And I'm like, you know, if you're not feeling a $230 million pitcher, then
Yeah.
don't feel one. And if you're feeling one, make sure it's the right one. And, you know, I'm not quick to spend their money. And people expect me to just want to kill them, right? And
Yeah.
like, I got enough, like, this isn't about my press credential. Like, that should be easy for them to do. This is $230 million, and talking about it as though it's sort of like we should just blink and play it in that game right away. I don't know. Even if I were
Right.
Rubenstein jumping into this, I'd be like, I'm not going to be like that freak with the Mets up there just throwing money at everything, and it still doesn't work. Let's let the baseball people do it. We'll have the money when it's time. And what I say to everybody, and this isn't my corporate line for sure, is, they have money and they have collateral. They have
Yeah.
the ability to make any deal on the table they want to make on July 30th. They can make the best deal for whatever pitcher they want. And as I said to this fellow over breakfast the other day, like, they've never in your lifetime, I said to him, he's a little younger than me. I said, in your lifetime, they have never, I've been on the radio 34 years, bro. 34 years, 34 trading deadlines, 34 years. Three owners now. Four, if you consider the other guy going bankrupt in a receivership. So I can't think of a July ever where they had anything, any. Well, we'll send them Jeffrey Hammonds and we'll send them whatever, Adam Lowen, make all these Dylan Bundy, throw all these names that nobody would have ever wanted that would have never have brought a one, and they weren't in a position to want any of that other than 2014 and
Well,
15 anyway. They really weren't in a, and they did deal. They got the big left-hander. They made a deal for Andrew Miller, right? So they were in a position to do a deal back then. So pretty much the only deal they've done of sort of that kind of consequence in a pennant race that's meant they haven't won a playoff game in 11 years or whatever it's been, right? So I would say for me, I am patient in regard to new ownership, confident in regard to the depth of their organization. And if they really need to get somebody else's one who's really available on a flailing team, they might have to give Jordan Westberg up to do it. You know, they might have to give a real player up to do it. They really might. They might have to say to Rutschman, hey, dude, we want an ace and we're going to go get that guy and we're going to do this and that. We're not going to pay you and we're going to let Pasayo catch. I mean, I don't know, but that's how this game gets played further on down the line. And I'm not nervous about Mike Elias and David Rubenstein's ability financially or with players to make acquisitions and make trades, which that was never the case here. They never wanted to spend money, even though the old man had it or didn't have it, depending on what you're listening to, what year we're talking about. And certainly they never had the ability to pull a trigger, to outbid anybody at a trading deadline with players. Never had it.
Yeah, I mean they had some players, but it would be only Dylan Bundy or only Hunter Harvey or only Jeffrey Hammonds way back when, right? I mean they would have one crown jewel piece where you'd say, well, we can't trade that guy. We need
Which
that guy.
would allow you to get Zach Eflin, but not
Yeah.
allow you to get Dylan Cease.
So you know we're gonna see, but to go back to your Max Fried thing, I mean Max Fried ended up, you know, signing with the Yankees 8 years, $218 million. 8 years, $218 million. So you say average annual value. Okay. Well,
27.
he's 31 years old. And as recently as last July, he was on the IL for a forearm issue. Now,
You're paying him $27 million a year in 30-31 and 30-32 in his age 37, 38, and 39 year. $30 million a year. You're gonna
well,
they need that money for Gunnar Henderson. I mean, they
Well,
just do.
and that's the difference right now. And look, the Orioles, let me be clear, because I do not want to come across sounding like one of these apologists for small market teams, right? Could the Orioles do that deal? Absolutely, they could do that deal. But what does it prohibit? How is it prohibitive for them if that deal goes sideways in the way that a lot of pitcher long-term pitcher contracts can. Look how much money the Rangers have given Jacob deGrom for what he's offered them to this point in the course of that deal. Now, a lot of people would tell you that was a dumb deal from the start based on how his last couple of years with the Mets had
Look,
gone.
it's
But
pitching, man. Strasburg, just go on
right.
and on and
And
on,
let's be
right?
clear. Let's be clear. When the Yankees or any team signs a pitcher to a deal like that, they know the back half of that deal is going to be a major L. They're banking on it being a major win for the next 3 years, right? The next 4 years that they're going to get surplus value, and then they're going to take a bath. You know, they're going to lose their shirt in the second half of the deal. But they'll say, hey, if it helps us win a World Series, then we'll take that. So for teams like the Yankees, who have huge markets, who have a much healthier TV rights outlook. I mean, the Orioles, who, as you know, we can dive into Masson here for 90 seconds. Okay, the Nats are going to explore their own TV rights now after 2025. Maybe they'll latch on to Ted Leonsis and Monumental and they'll be fine. Or maybe they're going to be talking to Major League Baseball in the way that the Cleveland Guardians and all these other teams are now having basically Major League Baseball broker their local TV rights. With the Orioles, you know, what is going to happen with Masson? You know, Nestor, if you ask me right now, do I think Masson exists 3 years from now? I'm going to say no, probably. I'm guessing it's going to go away, and you're going to see the Orioles, you know, in conjunction with Major League Baseball, whatever their future model is. And, you know, as I've said to people, do some research on what MLS has done with Apple TV and all of that. I'm guessing it's going to look something more like that over the course of the next 5 years. Or maybe Masson
Well,
will
it needs to be
survive.
rethought,
But right.
and then more than that, not just the strategy, but like the revenue model
Sure.
needs to be better than the Baltimore Banners or the Baltimore Suns.
No doubt. And to be clear, that doesn't mean the Orioles aren't going to be able to make money, but until you figure that out, how much can you make? What's your annual, you know, what's your projected revenue stream going to look like on that front in 2026, 27, 28, 29, 30? And oh yeah, there's a new CBA that'll be looming in that time period as well, with already hearing the union talk about lockouts. So the point is, if you're David Rubenstein and the Orioles, it's not that you can't spend money, but how much do you really want to extend yourself when you have such unknowns? Whereas the Dodgers, who have a colossal market, right? And the Mets, who have an owner who just, you know, has a checkbook that has an endless number of pages to it, and just will spend, spend, spend because he has the money. He's in a big market and he doesn't care, right? You know, if you're a team like the Orioles, you do need to be more measured and calculated about it. Again, and that's with in what I'm hoping it that includes trying to forecast and trying to keep Gunnar Henderson and keep Jordan Westberg, at least keeping a couple of your young guys long term. Not going to keep everyone. We know they're not going to get to a point where they're at a $300+ million payroll. I mean, how many teams in baseball can even say that? But they certainly are spending more money now than they did a year or two ago. It's big whoop. Of course, you couldn't spend any less than they did a couple years ago. But you want to make sure you're doing that in a way that will keep you healthy and flexible, right? You can do it. You could sign Max Fried, but what does that do in terms of impacting your flexibility over the next 3, 4, 5 years as some of these young guys get closer and closer to free agency? So we're going to see how it plays out, right?
I'm
And
okay with the way they've managed it. I just want to say that on the record.
that's fine. And look,
And I don't think they're winning the World Series with this particular group. I really don't, but I think they can get the kind of help they need in July. They can make decisions that will improve
that's
their
fair.
team. They need to be a better team October 1st than they are today. I'll
Yeah,
say that.
and I'll throw one more thing out there, and you know,
Because we've been at this for an hour, you and me.
sure. One more thing I want to throw out there, as it pertains to pitching, the Kittredge thing. I'll throw one name out there that's available right now. David Robertson is still a free agent. If this second opinion on the knee proves to be something that he's going to miss some real time, I'd love to see them say, okay, we're not going to pitter around here. We're not going to do the same thing with our bullpen. We need our bullpen to be locked down or close to it as the course of the season goes on. And, you know, as Felix Bautista gets more and more acclimated, I'd love to see them go out and get David Robertson if this Kittredge thing is a real concern. Because look, he's old. I'm not saying he's gonna, he's not the guy that he was as closer of the Yankees several, years ago. But if you look at the free agent graybeard relievers that are still out there, like Craig Kimbrell, for example, Robertson was the best last year out of that group. So if the Kittredge thing ends up being more of a concern where you're not going to have him to say like June or something like that, and again, that's pure speculation on my part, go out and get Robertson. So that would be the kind of move that it's not going to sink you from a long-term standpoint, but you're going to have to give him some real money on a one-year deal. That's something I'd like to see them do. And again, I'm mostly with you. Like I said, I would have liked to see them target a one-year deal on a guy with a little more volatility on the upside, from an upside perspective. But we'll see how it plays out. And I'll say this much, their starting pitching depth, while it's not the great upside ceiling that it is when you have Corbin Burns as your ace, obviously. But I think they have some viable depth arms, whether we're talking about Albert Suarez. Cade Povich has looked really good so far this year, or so far this spring, on the heels of having a good September. So we're talking about your number six and number seven starters right there. So, but this is all assuming the Grayson Rodriguez, whatever that start was on Wednesday, that he's okay, and that truly was, him just being sluggish, and he's not fully ramped up yet and all that. Because if there is something wrong with him, then everything we just talked about, all bets are off, and then it's like, okay, you need to go make a move. And you're going to have to make a move sooner than later, because that rotation without Grayson Rodriguez in it, that I shudder to think, then you're talking about not having enough, and not having enough in terms of upside.
Luke Jones is here. He has enough upside to get us through tampering period next week. I'll be watching the spring training games. Now that Gunnar's not playing, it's okay that we're not going to Florida. We're going to end the month in beautiful Toronto, Ontario, if they still let us in. I don't know if we have to pay a tariff when we cross the border or not. I love you, Canadian folks. Please. Let me in. Later on in the month, we'll be doing that. They'll let me in over at the CVP in Towson. I'm still welcome over there. Noon on Sunday as Towson and Pat Scarry's Cats gear up for a run. They play at 6 p.m. on Monday and then 7 p.m. on Tuesday if they continue to win in advance. We'll be at the CVP next Friday. We're at Fadley's this Thursday. And we are at Pizza John's on the 21st doing the Maryland Crab Cake Tour. All of it brought to you by the Maryland Lottery. He's Luke. I'm Nestor. We are WNSD, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, and we never stop talking Baltimore positive.